Welcome into Save Your Line, a podcast for Kansas Cityans by Kansas Cityans. We are the Rich Brothers. Today is September 22nd. Lots of twos in that date. Chiefs also 2-0 after the big dub on Sunday, which I got to have the full California experience watching. A little pregame in the pool.
Okay.
You know, nice. It was like 80 degrees and sunny out here. The smoke has finally cleared. So I got to watch the Chiefs from California beat the Los Angeles Chargers of California handily. Outdoors. Beautiful. Handily?
What? Did you watch the game?
Yeah, I did. I was just getting really excited about,
like, you just like got going in your in like your announcer voice, kind of where you just kind of talk and just kind of assume that the Chiefs won handily, and so you're just like, it just came out.
Yeah, it just came out, and but yeah, I gotta, you know, jump in the pool when I needed to cool off, because really it wasn't handily, and I was like pissed off most the entire game.
I hated that game.
One of those games where you had to change locations where you were watching it at some point to try to bring the mojo back. So I had to like go from outside down to the basement to harness some better energy.
Yeah. The, I hated that game. I was miserable the entire time. I didn't like
I'm
enjoy
so glad
a
I
second
didn't watch
of
with
it.
You.
Yeah. Oh, it was awful. And, it was one of those plays where, I had something to say after every single snap. And it was negative every time. And I had to catch myself and be like, Danny, shut up. Like, no one cares what you're saying. Because I was watching it with, you know, a group of like six other people. And it's just reactionary. Like, I have to, and I hate myself for it. It's so stupid. And so I'll say that out loud. Like, Danny, shut up. No one cares. Because I know that's what everyone is thinking. But yeah, it was a frustrating game. Many of the things that were coming out of my mouth were, our linebackers are trash and don't feel like tackling anyone. Why is Willie Gay not playing? Why is Dorian O'Daniel not playing? Those guys both made awesome plays on special teams. And I know it's special teams, but still, like, Damian Wilson and Anthony Hitchens cannot play linebacker in a modern NFL defense. They can't they can't guard in coverage. They're both decent at run at stopping the run, and they're decent linebackers in those situations, but they can't do it. So that was something I was constantly saying. Eric Fisher's name was getting buried on a very consistent basis. Those words were coming out of my mouth. You can't block to save his life. To be fair, Mitchell Schwartz didn't play good either. And
that was the worst game I've ever seen him play. Like,
because
I've never seen him play a bad game, but
he allowed
that was
seven
bad.
Pressures in that game. And for context, in the entire playoff run, so against the Texans, Titans, and 49ers, he allowed one pressure, or maybe zero pressures, one pressures in all three games of the playoffs. And on Sunday, he allowed seven pressures. And it was one of those situations where we were 8.5-point favorites. I thought we were going to blow them away. You kept on hearing about how fast the turf was in L.A. in their new stadium. And I was like, oh, our speed? Like, we're going to absolutely blow them away. And I honestly completely forgot that the Chargers do have a really good defense. And they have two all-pro, Pro Bowl D end and pass rushers in Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram. And they've got good cornerbacks, and Jim Nantz said it a few times, but they've been the team that has stifled Mahomes more than any other team. And so, while we still
the only team that he's lost a game to in the AFC West.
Yeah. And while we still have their number, like, I think we're 8-1 in the last, you know, 4 years against them.
I think that's like 12 of 13 now we've won against them. Yeah.
They still have played us tough. And so I kind of forgot about that. I thought we would win like 60-22. And so it was a frustrating game considering we had, you know, 6 points for a very long time.
Yeah. But again, I think what as frustrated as we are, imagine being a fan of another team in the AFC West playing us. Like, they did everything they could to like contain us, and 6 points in the first half,
And for really the three quarters, we couldn't do anything on offense. And they're playing with their backup quarterback who got the, you know, start at right at the last minute. He found that out, which actually was probably good for him. But again, they did everything they could, and then Mahomes just says, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna do this. Throw it 50 yards off my back foot to Tyreek Hill for a touchdown, where he somersaults into the end zone."
Yeah,
it's like, well, God dang it! And then okay, 3rd and 20, we've got him. We guarded everybody. We played the perfect defense. I'm gonna run for 20 yards.
Yeah,
like imagine the frustration there.
Yeah, these are the things we were talking about when before the season. We were talking about why we're excited for the season, and one of them is we get new Patrick Mahomes highlights highlights because I know you and myself, I've watched every YouTube video, I've watched every highlight package, I've watched every, like, you know, some random YouTuber with 11 views put together a Mahomes highlight package. I've watched it. I needed more Mahomes content. And yeah, we got it this weekend with the throw to Tyreek and the 20-yard scramble.
The 3rd and 20 scramble.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I agree.
So
we shouldn't have cared that much anyways. It was like a week 2 game, and I was sweating it like out through my Chris Jones jersey.
It was weird. It was weird. The no crowd is weird. Like every player talked about it. Like how weird it was, because their first game was, you know, in front of fans. So, you know, this was the first time they had played it without fans. And man, that just is bizarre. Everyone said it was hard to get into at the beginning.
The, I mean, but Butker, man, can't say enough about,
God, what a pro.
I mean, I knew that like a lot of people kind of had been talking about it. Like a lot of NFL people, have been talking about how he's the best kicker in the NFL now. And I haven't really thought about it, but I know Justin Tucker is still out there and still playing, but I don't know if Justin Tucker is nailing 58 yarders two in a game. If you saw Arrowhead Pride wrote an article about, or interviewed him about it. And he said, you know, each kick he learned something new. And adjusted accordingly. So the timeout did not work. The false start didn't really hurt him because he got a read on the wind and kind of the air pressure in there. I guess it's like kind of humid in there and kind of messes with the air pressure. So he got a good read on that, on the 53-yarder with the false start. And then the timeout, he thought he overswung. So and that's what put a little bit of weird spin on it. So he kind of just took a little off for the third kick. And just nailed it perfectly. But I don't know
if
you've
seen... And then turn around and walk away.
Okay. Have you seen that video?
Yes, I have.
Have you seen the conspiracy theory?
No, I have not.
I just saw this breaking news.
Okay, so Harrison Butker kicks it. The ball is about halfway to going in, and he's not even looking. He's already walking around.
Yeah.
So, like, I got it. I made it. I need to hear this conspiracy.
Tommy Townsend, our punter, the holder, he picks something off the turf in that video, and it looks like maybe was it a little tea? Was it a little kicking tea?
Oh no, I have not heard that.
Yes, so I just saw this like literally 2 minutes before we decided to start recording.
Did like Chargers fan 972583
absolutely
put this video out?
Okay, but go watch the video again. It can't be bigger than a quarter because you can't even see anything, but he definitely reaches down and picks something up.
Ooh,
and
wow,
then goes and celebrates with Butker and just, you know, runs into the mob and everything. So just a little tickler.
Okay.
We'll see.
Put that in the file. We'll see. We'll see. Also, one other thing, not game related. I'm kind of done with the Andy Reid face shield fascination.
Oh, the memes are, it's just an excuse to make memes.
It was easy. It was funny. Like, all right, let's just.
That graphic CBS put up, they knew it was trash. And like, even Nance was like, this is ridiculous, but.
Yeah. Okay. I'm done. Let's move on. it's not, I'm just not getting any laughs out of that.
So we're moving on from face shield jokes and Damian Wilson and Anthony Hitchens. Got it.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Anything
but
else?
Ravens week. I mean,
yeah, I know.
Huge game. We were kind of talking about it last week, how it might be, you know, people might be looking ahead. I don't think they were, especially in the second half when they realized, you know, we're getting beat.
Right.
We can't look ahead. But, and I don't think pros do that, but, Ravens week. I mean, the Ravens, I mean, if we're all being 100% honest with ourselves, the Ravens have looked much better than the Chiefs in the first 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Ravens have looked more like their 2019 selves than the Chiefs have looked like their 2019 selves. And so, I'm really interested. I will start having like real opinions and not just like reactionary hot takes about the Chiefs after mm-hmm. this upcoming game.
Yeah. Mahomes 2-0 lifetime against Lamar Jackson. And there's a stat, like the Chiefs haven't lost in Baltimore. We've lost one time in Baltimore.
Is it in Baltimore?
The Ravens. Yeah, it's in Baltimore. We've lost like one time against the Ravens. And like, it was like one of those years where like, it was like Brody Croyle. No, it was like Brody Croyle or Thigpen or Palko or like one of those guys was playing quarterback. So really, besides that year, we've won every game in Baltimore. So
Andy Reid versus John Harbaugh.
Good matchup.
All right.
Let's switch gears. Talk a little bit Royals since this is it. They're going to be done playing by the time we have our next episode. And
really?
Man.
Are you
serious?
They're
going to be done September 27th, Sunday. I don't think they're mathematically eliminated right now, but
I think they're five games out.
Six. With seven to play. So I don't think it's going to happen. Do have a chance to do this week is play spoiler for the Cardinals. We play three games against the Cardinals this week starting Monday. So they have a three game lead in that wild card / NL Central 2 spot. So they're very much on the bubble, on the right side of it now. But we could play spoiler for the Cardinals, and I'm here for that. So that's definitely something to play for and something to watch for. And then, I mean, just tune in and watch Salvador Perez mash baseballs because he's hitting everything.
He should, if he didn't miss games, and granted, take all of this with like a grain of salt here real quick because it's a really small sample size. But if he didn't miss games and if he was better at framing pitches, MVP conversation.
Definitely would be. I mean, he's hitting 361. I think his OPS is over 1,000.
Like, oh, yeah. It's like 1,100 now.
It's insane. He's 17 of his last 34 as we record this since he's come back from, again, the weird blurred vision thing. So, he could have been in the MVP conversation if he would have put numbers up like that.
And if he framed pitches better.
And
don't forget about
too.
That.
Well, he's still a gold glover, Danny. Speaking of MVPs, people are still trying to tell me that Mondesi has MVP potential. I think Whit Merrifield said it, and I think Salvi backed it up and Matheny backed it up. And I mean, he has had a nice last 10 games. I think he's hitting over 300, but I need to see something more than like a 10 game stretch of getting hot because it's been pretty bad this year. So
dude, Salvi's last seven games, he's slugging 1,033.
Yeah, it's incredible. Since he's been back, four home runs, five doubles. I mean, he's just absolutely on fire. So
all right, well, thanks for reminding me that the Royals existed. I kind of forgot. So
play
I appreciate
spoiler.
The reminder.
And what I think I decided, because Salvi also said we're like that, he feels like it's like 2013 again, but like in my head, we had those, you know, top prospects from like a couple years ago who like everyone said were, you know, top 10 prospects up. I just need to channel my inner K-State fan and be okay with like our 2 and 3 star guys, like, and think, okay, we can still be really good with them, even though like Hunter Dozier was never a big prospect, and Witt, and who else am I leaving out? I don't know. Those are some of the guys that I think of that I'm like, well, I was never really excited about them, so I have no faith in this offense to do anything. But I'm like, all right, but they're good. They're solid players. Maybe there is something there.
All right.
So
I'm a Mizzou fan, so all we care, we're very superficial. We only care about our like what rivals ranks our recruiting class. So that's
right.
About it.
Yeah,
we're very superficial fan base.
Yeah, I mean the Bill Snyder era, we did not care. It was just like, all right, recruiting rankings come out, we're gonna be like last, whatever.
Yeah,
that's fine. So maybe I just need to channel that and not worry about what they were as prospects and just take them for what they are as major leaguers. All right, let's move into a little openings and closings. You've got two places that Taco Republic and
Graham
Dunn.
I'm gonna run this segment as just an opening and closing because they're all interconnected. Okay.
Okay.
So all as right. We've talked about a couple of times, Bread and Butter Concepts, the restaurant group that owned Stock Hill Grill, Urban Table, BRGR. Taco Republic, Graham and Dunn, the Oliver on the Plaza. Mm-hmm. That restaurant group has slowly been dying and officially died in August of this year. So, but I think they still have Stock Hill, the steakhouse. I think nothing says that they don't. Because back in like 2017, 2018, they sold BRGR and Taco Republic to the owners of Louis Wine Dive. And they still operate and own those. They kept Graham and Dunn and the others. Well, they filed for bankruptcy. So they had to sell Graham and Dunn and close Urban Table. So that's what they did. They sold Graham and Dunn to the owners of Louis Wine Dive. And they're going to, Louis Wine Dive or Graham and Dunn's going to continue to operate basically how it has. It's the name's not changing, the concept's not changing, everything's the same. The owners of Louis Wine Dive are opening a new Taco Republic in Prairie Village in the old Arby's. You know that Arby's in Corinth Square?
Yes.
Like on 83rd Street?
Uh huh. Okay.
They're turning that into a Taco Republic. They're, you know, obviously shrinking the size of the indoor restaurant, making a big patio grass area, kind of like their one on 47th and Mission by Oklahoma Joe's. So that's going to be a Taco Republic. However,
they
are closing Louis Wine Dive in Waldo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So RIP, an established place that's been there, I think, since 2011.
That's the first place I'd ever heard of bottomless Mimos at.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Wine Dive.
They were one of the first, and because of that, it used to be impossible.
The Wild West of bottomless mimosas.
And it was impossible to get a table there for brunch. Mm-hmm. Like, this was right when I graduated college, and brunch was everything. Hashtag brunch is everything. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't get a place at like going to Louis, forget about it. But so Louis Wine Dive and Waldo is closing. They're saying, you know, Corona, and I guess they got flooded a lot and they were tired of that building and they were tired of the landlord and them not fixing the problem of the flooding. So Louis Wine Dive closing in Waldo, new Taco Republic opening where the Arby's was on 83rd Street and Mission Road, Graham and Dunn staying the same. Both the Taco Republic and Graham and Dunn operated by the Louis Wine Dive owner. And Urban Table is just closing for good in Corinth Square.
In Corinth. Okay.
Yeah. So all that's kind of connected. By the way, I think the last time I went to an Arby's was that Arby's when I was like in eighth grade riding my bike down there for $5 for $5.55. We talked about it on the fast food
podcast.
Yeah. But
with the bracketologist.
I can't believe that Arby's was still open because I never saw anyone in it.
Nope, never did. Always saw a now hiring sign outside of it. Who they were hiring and to do what, I don't know, because no one was going in there for food. But I just saw a commercial for the Arby's like Philly cheesesteak, and damn, it looks good.
Good commercials.
The commercials.
You're never going to buy it. Also, I mean, it's a bummer about Louis Wine Dive in Waldo. That was a good spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'll be interested to see what goes in there, but I really hope that doesn't like kill like District and like that other, that, you know, that whole stretch. Hopefully something awesome goes in there.
Ooh, maybe I need to open up my brunch restaurant there.
There you go.
F yes. Okay. Wow. I don't like floods, so
yeah,
we'll see. I'll have to talk to the landlord. All right. So all that interconnected. Taco Republic opening new location. Graham and Dunn staying. Urban Table, Louis Wine Dive, RIP.
RIP.
All right. So let's talk a little what we tried this week. I brought a couple of these little treats out with me to California.
When are you going to – you can try something in California and report about it.
Yeah, but then, like, no one can do it. Like, just on a Wednesday, just for the heck of it, I went to the beach and, you know, had a picnic and watched the sunset over
just
the Golden Gate Bridge. So that was just a Wednesday. I'm going to go to Tahoe for, like, 5 days here coming up.
Are you going to work out there?
Yeah. Just work from Tahoe, probably looking over the mountains, work outside. So I don't know if anyone wants to hear about that.
Okay. Thank you.
So I did bring a couple of these roastery cold brew cans with me. It's a roastery cold brew Columbia Caca? Caucha?
Cacao.
I think that's a region in Colombia where they grow the beans, cacao. And so they come in these little like 8 ounce cans, the cold brew does, and travels well and is the perfect amount of cold brew.
Just a little bit of cocaine.
A little bit of crack. So just 8 ounces. Like sometimes if you get the 16 ounce cold brew, I mean, you're not going to sleep for a week, or at least I'm not. But a little 8 ounce roastery cold brew cans, very easy to take with you. Would recommend. Great taste, great flavor. I mean, just classic roastery. But sometimes I worry about, you know, taking something like local like that and bottling it for, you know, kind of for retail. But again, kept the taste very well. Roastery coffee, always delicious.
Is that how you get hyped for, you know, the 10 a.m. kickoff for the NFL?
Yeah, and I love the 10 a.m. 10 a.m. kick is beautiful. Had some waffles at like 9:30 as I'm watching, you know, NFL Today, rolling out of bed. It's lovely. Sunday night football is over by 8:30. It's awesome. Like I refuse to give in.
I love Central Time Zone
every,
so much.
I would fall asleep every Sunday night football almost.
Yeah, sometimes I kind of like that though.
Oh no, I like it being done, and I like games being done a little earlier too. NBA games getting done earlier. I would always fall asleep during those, but now everything's done earlier, so I honestly watch more sports. I think it'd be a different story if, like, you had to commute and go to work from 8 to 5 or 8 to 6 and then try to come home.
Exactly.
It'd be a different story there. But hanging out at home all day, I'm able to catch the 5 o'clock starts, you know, for NBA, and it's easy.
Monday night football and Thursday night football, if you're commuting, you have to rush home to get home for a 5 o'clock game.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be tough. But without the commute,
you're in a perfect situation. All right. Shut up.
Yes.
Okay. Okay,
I went to the beach last week too.
Yeah.
Okay.
I tried J and S Pizza in Liberty.
Liberty, Northland, Dan.
The nice thing about having a newborn baby is everyone wants to come see the baby, and they feel like they have to bring you food in order to come see the baby.
Yes.
So I've just been eating a lot of pizza, a lot of lasagna. I fucking love lasagna. Like, if you ever just want, like, hey, what does Danny want to eat?
Lasagna.
You can't go wrong with lasagna. I'm like Garfield. Garfield, I hate Mondays and I love lasagna. So our friends brought us some J&S pizza. They're from Liberty. They brought us some J&S pizza. That stands for Josh and Sherry, if you're wondering.
Thanks, Josh and Sherry.
We got meat lover, half meat lovers and half Hawaiian pizza.
Get the fuck off my pizza, pineapple.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad.
No,
so,
no, that's, come on. Come on. It wasn't. No, don't even try to.
The pizza, no. The pizza's good. I think the owners, it has definitely has like a pizza shop type crust, but it's not nearly as like crackery, I guess.
Okay.
And like closer to like Old Shawnee pizza. So kind of similar crust to a pizza shop in Old Shawnee. But really good. Really good cheese. Really good everything. We got this appetizer called Zesty Balls. Those are good. So I'd never had this pizza.
Wasn't
so
that your nickname at FICAP?
Yeah. Old Zesty Balls Ritz. They, you know, when you're ordering from somewhere new, especially like a bar or a pizza place, you got to find something on the menu that's like unique to them and has a crazy name. So we went with Zesty Balls, which are meatballs wrapped in like basically deep fried meatballs wrapped in kind of pizza dough, like pizza dough type breading. So good stuff. Yeah. JNS Pizza. And if you want to come meet my baby, fine, but you got to bring me food. So.
Got to bring food. All right, so that's it for the front half. We've got a fun interview with the folks who organized the West 18th Street Fashion Show this year. It's its 20th year that the West 18th Street Fashion Show is going to be kicking off.
A little range. Kev and I showing some range. We can do we can do anything. We can talk fashion and art, which is what we did with four different people we were interviewing, I think. Or we can, you know, talk Zesty Balls and whatever else.
Yes, yeah. So, and then we've got a fun mixed plate at the back of this episode related to it, where we're going to talk our most regrettable fashion trends that we participated in. But we have this interview brought to us by our good friends at Metcalf Partners.
Were you going to do it?
I don't. You got it. I mean, Metcalf Partners, Ethan Hutchison, he's my guy. I'm handing in the keys to my kingdom. You know, he's helping me out. But can't say enough good things about the work that Ethan has helped me out with. Really helped educate me on what a 401k is. I learned about Roth 401ks, helping me where to save money, where to invest money. A very awesome educational process so far.
Had you ever spoken with a financial advisor before?
Yes, in 2007, I invested a lot of money as a learning experience from all the money I'd saved up in high school, and then 2008 happened. So since then, I've been emotionally scarred and unwilling to invest.
Yeah, but once you got the educational process from Metcalf Partners Wealth Management, everything started to make sense, and you decided to go ahead and let...
Yeah, because I went to the School of Hard Knocks in 2008. That was the School of Hard Knocks. Now I'm the School of Metcalf Partners. Much better.
Yeah.
Much better.
So again, Metcalf Partners Wealth Management, they want to help you out. They want to help you get your money in order, help it start working for you. Reach out to Ethan Hutchison like Kevin has. You can find him on LinkedIn or Instagram are the easiest ways to get a hold of him. Or just go to MedcalfPartners.com. Again, MedcalfPartners.com. They're a great sponsor of the show. If you talk to them, tell them that you heard about their group on State Your Line.
All right, perfect. All right, that's a good place to start then. All right, so I'm going to do my best with the names. We just went over them. I'm so terrible with names. Danny makes fun of me every time if I mess them up. So just jump in and correct me if I get them wrong. But we're joined by... today, some of the big players in the West 18th Street Fashion Show this year. We have a couple executive producers, Celeste
Lupercio.
Lupercio. We have Peregrine Honig. Got that there. She's also the senior artistic director, and she wrote the movie that's going to be featured, and the movie that is going to be featuring Calvin Arsenia. He's going to be the talent and the musical director of the fashion show. So now that I finally got like the hard part out of the way, we can just talk. I'm excited for that. All right. So Celeste, I, you know, obviously things couldn't go off as normal this year with the fashion show. And I don't want to steal your thunder too much talking about the changes that you've made, but we've got a movie coming out instead that's going to be shown. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the movie that's coming out and how you decided on that medium for the fashion show.
Right. Well, you know, Peregrine is also a great person to ask that question to because she's the one who came up with that idea. But we went through so many ideas. It's such a clever group of producers and ideas ranged all over the place. And when this idea for a movie came up, you know, I think we were all kind of just like, what? Peregrine, we're just gonna let you talk because we're pretty sure you're nuts. And by the end, we were all convinced and we're like, okay, yeah, let's do a movie. So we're making a movie. We have shot the movie and we are now in post-production. And it is going to be airing at Boulevard Drive-In Theater October 16th. Tickets are on sale on Eventbrite now.
Wow.
So Peregrine, go ahead, Kev, sorry.
Oh, I mean, I was probably going to ask the same thing as you. Peregrine, I know you kind of are in fashion by trade. So had you ever done anything like produce a movie before, and where did this idea come from?
Well, I'm not so much into fashion as I'm into the West 18th Street fashion show. So
okay,
I would probably label myself a fine artist before somebody would agree with the label of like a fashion designer or anything like that, and maybe a second tier would be to say that I'm a curator. So I would even say with people. And I'm extremely proud of my board. Like, I cannot believe that we are doing this. And I've been involved in the West 18th Street Fashion Show for 2 decades. And I really was so excited that it was our 20th year. And we had 3 people that we had brought in by invitation. And I was just brainstorming. And as we all know, it was such a dark time. Like, what are we going to do? And we were thinking about, I was like, oh, could we, I had already started to send out letters like, I'm gonna try and do drive-in, like project movies onto the front of my building. I was just trying to do anything. I was sending letters to friends because I just wanted something to do with my hands to reach out to people that I couldn't see. And then we were talking about working with the World War I Museum, just so prominent, and I worked with them before, and Missy, who is a fashion designer, said, well, we wouldn't be able to see anything. And then I started to think, oh, we've always wanted to do a documentary of this, so this would be the year, because there's so many people that are gonna be bound to where we are. And then I thought, oh my God, we should do it at the drive-in. And I had the realization while we were on a Zoom meeting. And as soon as it hit, it was the answer. And I could see Calvin, and I could see how it would translate from the runway, like from, I was saying, from the street to the screen. And it took some convincing. I was convincing myself for sure. And then as soon as everybody got on board, I've kind of been referring it to as it as like the best snowball. Like, we started off and it just kept more and more amazing people just kind of caught on to the, you know, the snowball of it.
I imagine when you have that many like artists and creative people in a room together, the snowball can get pretty large. What were some or get kind of out of control? What were some other ideas that you guys were throwing around about how to obviously it's your 20th year. You want this to be as big a deal as possible. What were some other ideas that you guys were throwing around besides
not,
making a movie?
Not doing it at all.
Not doing it?
Yeah, that was the other idea.
It wasn't just like put Calvin up in the middle of the street and just have people just come and flock towards him as he plays.
That's what a drive-in is, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the movie you guys are making, tell me a little bit about it. Is it the documentary that you had always planned to make, or did it become something different? Is it a scripted kind of, I guess, fictional, not documentary piece of work?
Calvin, what is it?
Well, actually, that question is still evolving, I think. We've got before COVID hit, there was documentation happening of each of the designers receiving their invitation or the news that they had been selected to be a part of what would be the 20th year on West 18th Street here in Kansas City. And that street, just as a slight side note, has been kind of the center of my experience in Kansas City. I remember I grew up in Olathe, but my experience of Kansas City was always First Fridays when I was in, you know, as a late teenager, and I'd come down to First Fridays when it was still the Arts Incubator. And I would head straight for the Bower. So like that was like where I'd start. And then I would wander, you know, to and from the Bower, like just like every time I would come down to the city. So it's just really incredible to be a part of this project in general. But because it was being documented and kind of getting the responses and some of that behind the scenes things, I think we have potential to create a lot of different kinds of iterations of this year and of this movie and of this fashion show. I know that Peregrine and I and others have talked about using some of that behind the scenes footage in a finished product of Summer in Hindsight. And, you know, I haven't really seen that much of a crossover between like documentary and like more narrative style of a film before. So what I love about this project and about these people and about kind of the strangeness of this really unfortunate time is that art always follows like the narrative of what's happening in the world and shifts and changes. And artists have to be, have to learn how to pivot and how to outsmart the circumstances. And how do we, you know, what can we do that is going to be safe and creative and not just a knockoff or like a lesser experience than something that we had previously with different rules, you know? How do we in turn use what we are given to make something that is actually enjoyable and actually beautiful and actually dynamic and actually like valuable? So that's kind of been the whole the process for us.
Yeah. I love that you guys are like evolving with the times and you're making the best of things. Cause I was thinking about fashion during this time and I'm like, it's 90% like sweatpants and t-shirts for me. Cause I don't really leave the house. So like when you guys are selecting, you know, designers before this, kind of what's the process for that? And did anything change because of the pandemic as far as like what the designers were bringing to the show?
We had put a call for designers, as we do every year. It's a public call. It's very inexpensive to apply, and we get a lot of applications, and it's sort of our first little nest of money for postcards. And I had literally just finished graduating from college, so you can imagine my graduation was, I mean, I got my cap and gown and I put it in the costume closet. Mm-hmm. But I'd taken a class on the Bauhaus, on Walter Gropius, and his thinking and his take on design being accessible and the idea of things working well. And again, just the way that politics and accessibility of art and the accessibility of design had affected this very interesting time in you know, it being its 100th year. And so that is what we presented, the sort of triadic ballet by Oscar Schlemmer, which is a breakdown of the human experience into obviously three sections. And so we had intended to do the show in these three pieces already. So we chose our designers conceptually based on their reaction to the Bauhaus. Like Calvin was already thinking about the music and these very abstract things, because the year before we had done Summer Adorned, which was very much about the exploration of, you know, I would say like hereditary self-decoration, like ceremonial situations, dense embroidery, lots of sequins, these very kind of over the top and gaudy even aesthetics. So I really, with the 20th year, wanted to be sparse and be even challenge our designers to do something that was not so immediately conventionally beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I have a question about that. Just made me think about, you know, fashion shows in general. Is that how they work? Is it the organizer of the fashion show says, all right, this is going to be our theme, and then we're going to, or kind of what we're looking for, and then send out to designers and then they submit it? Or how does that work? It sounded like that's kind of what you were saying, but now you're shaking your head. Oh no, she froze.
I think she was saying that no, that's not how typical fashion shows are run.
Okay.
So, but that is definitely what this one is like, and there's a selection process that goes through the board of directors, and I was not a part of that process, so I'm just kind of feeling
okay.
But yeah, no, this concept of kind of having a theme, is very unique to the West 18th Street Fashion Show. And I think that's something that makes it stand out amongst other kinds of fashion shows. So, I mean, when we talk about fashion, we're talking about storytelling, and we're talking about mm-hmm. culture, and we're talking about function, and we're talking about, you know, it's not just beauty. It's not just pretty people walking down a runway. These are artists and designers and storytellers.
And the West 18th Fashion Show, you are always, I mean, Calvin, obviously you bring music to it, and you're the kind of the music side of the film itself, but the West 18th Fashion Show, you guys are always looking to collaborate with other forms of art, you know, all the galleries down in the Crossroads, and musicians and poets. What's the process like to find the other artists that you want to? Oh, hi. Okay, so Calvin explained kind of how the West 18th Street Fashion Show is a little different from other fashion shows, and that you do have a theme, and it's a little more themed than a traditional fashion show. And encompassed in that theme is all other forms of art. Like music, like Calvin does. I know you involve poets and you know, traditional paintings and drawings and that form of art. So again, is it all right, we've got a theme. Now we're going to reach out to all these different artists, whether they're poets or musicians or painters, and we want them all to collaborate for this show?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a, we put out a call for designers, and then that, so publicly, like Celeste and April will basically make it, you know, send it to the Art Institute, to different schools, to different organizations that are, you know, garment focused. And then like the Kansas City Museum will put it out, and then we wait for the applications, and then we see what people present to us and what they would like to do with the idea of it. And then we choose the designers according to what we feel is the highest quality.
Got it. And are most of the designers for the show, is it a requirement that you're from Kansas City, or is it a Midwest thing, or kind of where do these designers all come from?
Most of the designers are regional. This year, I reached out to two New Orleans designers. I was interested in having a conversation about, you know, the aesthetic along the Mississippi. And so we have two designers that were from New Orleans, and they were by invitation. And they had started last year the New Orleans Independent Fashion Show, which felt very similar to the beginnings of the West 18th Street Fashion Show. So I definitely wanted to build a bridge between their project and our project.
And what are those beginnings? You know, you talked about it being the 20th anniversary and having similar beginnings to New Orleans. How did this whole thing get started? Because the West 18th Street Fashion Show is an event, but it's also an organization, correct? And so what were the origins of the organization and the origins of the event back in 2000?
The West 18th Street Fashion Show started off as Isabel's. It was like a small boutique owned by Debbie Burrell and her daughter Claire, and they would put a platform in the middle of the street, and it was live music, and maybe 10 to 30 people would show up. And then when they stopped running Isabel's, I had started to run Birdie's. It was kind of a natural transition. And so we have just continued to interview them for the history of our event. And at like kind of the snowball metaphor, we continue to get people who are very strong at like event projects. Ashley Broom and Sarah Snodgrass were an early board members who were really good at throwing events. Celeste obviously is super pro. So we've just gotten higher and higher quality. And we have a really fluid board. Like the best thing about our board is when people are too busy or they're ready to move on. It's not like a big nonprofit, you know, difficult thing. Like somebody can just say, hey, I'm working on this project. I'll come back next year. And it's a really respectful and creative and driven group of people. So, I mean, more than an organization, it's just a very, very intelligent and very flexible group of people. So that's awesome.
Yeah. So Calvin, you just joined the board. This will be your second year. As the music director, how do you decide kind of what to compose and what to put out music wise for the for the show that was last year, the live show, and then the movie? Is it, you know, you're just kind of, you're going to watch the footage and then let it move you? Or I'm not musical. I'm not a creative person, and I'm always curious creative people how they go about their creative process.
I think if you investigate your life, you would find that you're a lot more creative than you think you are.
That's all I was trying to do, is just get a compliment out of you. So thank you.
I was
fishing for a compliment there.
Many faces. But so for me, you know, I like to put together events and I like to blow people's minds. And I know that I kind of have, you know, a little bit of a recipe or a spell book as far as like how to do that. And it comes from a lot of vulnerability and intuition and following the muses wherever they tell me to go. And so with this particular event, as with all events, you want to think about the venue. And I put myself in the position of the audience member, and I sit down in their seat, and I imagine what, you know, from a view from afar, what does it feel like as the show is ending? What is it going to take for me in that position to feel the need to stand up and clap and scream and holler while I'm crying? Like I need to summon this very visceral reaction to respond. And so then I work backwards. I work my way backwards back to today. And like, how do I get all the things, all the ducks in a row to make sure that is the response that I'm getting from anybody who's sitting in the audience. And so last year that looked very different. You know, we were able to use and have access to the upstairs on either side of the West West 18th Street. And I had arranged parts for horn players to play from the balcony in the windows, as the, you know, normally the width or the of the screen or the parameter of the fashion show has been on the catwalk. But I really wanted to burst that open and let the sky be the ceiling and make people kind of look up and feel that as that, you know, more of a stadium feel. This year with the film, we're working in several, 19 locations, I believe.
10 days.
Yeah, 19 locations in 10 days. And also looking at, because this is a fashion show, right? So it's really important to me that the music and the performance, it's never my intention for that stuff to overshadow or to get in the way of what is the clothing. And so I'm trying to provide a sonic bed, a sonic framework, a sonic frame to elevate the experience of feeling the stories behind these clothes. And so I've interviewed all of the designers. I'm very intimately acquainted with how they work, what inspires them individually, what kind of music that they like to listen to, stuff that they grew up listening to, or stuff that they listen to now as they're creating things. And I'm still in the midst of completing the music for this for the movie. And yes, it does premiere in a month and 2 days. but I think from the get-go, something that we all have in common as the people who are putting this project together is that we're just a bit more ambitious than we ought to be, and that we often accomplish the things that we set out to do. So
that's like when your teacher asks, like, "Oh, how's the paper coming?" And you just like kind of start bullshitting. You're like, "No, you know," in your head, like, "Oh, I'm only a quarter of the way through my paper. I should."
You've been researching. We've been researching.
It's researching. Exactly.
You said you got to film over 19 different locations. So is that kind of a new thing to be able to show off all these different parts of Kansas City in the fashion show? Because I guess, you know, live, you were kind of restricted to where you were a little bit. So how'd you go about choosing some of those locations, and what were a couple of favorite locations that are going to be featured?
The last?
Well, there's really, I don't know how we would have done this if it wasn't for the pandemic, because the fact that all these locations were closed, and there were some that were starting to open back up, and they, even though they were opening back up, they were still so gracious to us to let us in. So, but them being closed did allow us into some spaces we wouldn't have been allowed into, and we did end up at 19 locations, but let me tell you how many locations we scouted, because, you know, this has been evolving. So the idea of what the movie was at the beginning is so markedly different than what it is now, and who knows what we'll see on the screen. But not only did the screenplay change, but also, I mean, just all the ideas that you know played into this. So as it all evolved, you know, we were at one time at 4 o'clock at night, we decided we needed a different location, and we were there by 7 o'clock the next morning. 4 o'clock on a Sunday night, this is how gracious Kansas City is. They got a hold of all their board members, got it approved, and we were there at 7 o'clock in the morning, the very next morning. Where does that happen? Nowhere but Kansas City. I'm sorry. It's amazing. This city is great. And that's the bonus to this movie, is we get to feature Kansas City, and I know that's what you guys are about, and that's what I'm about. That's my jam, is Kansas City. So the fact that we get to show it off in a way that no other movie I can imagine has ever shown off any city will do.
Yeah, and speaking of Kansas City, like showing things off, what are some, are there things in fashion like specific to Kansas City? Like in my brain, it's like a Hart KC shirt. But like real fashion, you know what I mean? Like, or do we kind of pick up things from maybe like a Chicago or like other Midwest cities nearby when it comes to like Kansas City fashion?
Well, if you go to the River Market, I mean, like, you know, you'll see a beautiful woman, like a Sudanese woman in something. You'll see incredible garments worn by all different sorts of people from all over the world. So I'm a big believer that you tell the story of who you are with the clothes that you wear, and that really doesn't have, it's not as much of a geographic burden as we like to pretend. Like, we're not just like barbecue and sports, and I mean, you can buy anything that is purchasable online, but if you want to travel and you want to actually have an authentic experience and you want to, you know, eat real authentic food from places, these things take time and grace and navigation. So I believe that's true wherever you go. Like, you can be in a really remote village, or you can be in Paris, or you can be in Kansas City. It's just, are you looking, or are you seeing, right? Like, are you buying something that's $3 for $20 that's being made at the compromise of somebody else's hands and then ending up in a landfill when things on sale are not even worth restocking? Or are you taking the time to buy less things that are higher quality and made with more conviction. And that's not a location thing. That's just a mindset. So, you know, it's the same thing can be said. Like, do you want to talk about Kansas City as, you know, fountains and barbecue and sports, or do you want to talk about it as a location that's got one of the most exquisite, you know, collections of Asian art? Or do you want to talk about it as a place where Charlie Parker played music? Like, wherever you go, there you are.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, one of the main goals of the fashion show is to, you know, expose local designers and show the art that they're producing. But like you were saying, is there a larger mission, or is there a larger goal that the fashion show or the organization has, other than the, you know, exposing local and regional designers?
Yeah. I don't know if, you saw, we just had April Dion join us. She is the director of communications. So I don't know, April, I mean, that kind of sounded a little bit up your alley, that question there.
Good timing.
I know, right? Just come in at the right time. Yeah, before. You wanted to know, Danny, if we provide a platform beyond just fashion, like for the artists, or can you kind of rephrase your question a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, Peregrine was talking about how your goal is more than just fashion, you know, and it's more than just like exposing designers or, you know, buying a piece of clothing that makes you happy. Obviously there's more to it than that. And if there are other goals of the organization, if it's, you know, especially this year, if it's exposing certain artists, if that is a larger goal this year, and every year, there's probably something more to it than just a fashion show, right?
Oh yeah. Every year we strive to be bigger and better. It's our 20th year. So this year was going to be, you know, definitely one to remember. We just did not expect it to be pandemic rememberable.
Yeah.
That's a word. But no, honestly, we really want it. It kind of went align with the pandemic, right? Where anxiety and depression is at an all-time high. And especially as it relates to the arts and entertainment, like a lot of artists and entertainers are out of, and even places you would go for that entertainment, they're not able to service or be a part of the things that give them happiness. And we as consumers, those things give us happiness, music and art and all those things. And not being able to experience it was really kind of creating a gloom, you know, I see, because part of my job, of course, is the director of communications for the West 18th Street Fashion Show, but I'm also social media manager for the city of Kansas City. So I get to see the, you know, both, how it's affecting the community at large. And so, I don't know, we wanted to really make sure with this project that we were giving the entertainers and the artists an opportunity to still be able to hone and do those skills that make them happy. And then we also wanted to give the audience the experience to be a part of the tradition that makes them happy. This is a 20-year show. So people are used to coming to this show together with their girlfriends, with their homies, with their kids, everyone as a community and experiencing that together. And we wanted to make sure we brought some type of normalcy and consistency to the community that's been shooken so hard.
And what does Summer in Hindsight mean? So the name of the movie is Summer in Hindsight. That came from somewhere. It was probably one of those huge creative processes and creative meetings again, but kind of where did that name come from, and how does it relate to like what April was saying about the anxiety and the depression that we're facing because of the pandemic and everything else?
I'd pitched the idea of Summer in Hindsight before the pandemic. So in reference to the Bauhaus, because of a fascist government, they had to move locations three times for these different reasons. And I was just thinking about the idea of how we navigate oppression, and also this idea that, you know, depression is the past and anxiety is the future. So what would we have done differently? Like you do anything for 20 years, you live for 20 years, you know, how would you do things differently? What would you do better? And so this idea of Summer in Hindsight, we've always done something in our title to deal with with summer. And so it made sense with, you know, our graphic designer. And often our meetings are very succinct because we are a very intuitive group of people. So it's never that, there's never a lot of conflict. We just sort of all get to an agreement pretty quickly because it feels right. You know, and because we don't really have to answer to anybody else but each other, and feeling right is a very you can't really put it, nail it down, but we work with a lot of people where it just, if something works, it works. And so summer in hindsight was what we decided on. And you know, it really has been extremely important as we are fighting for equality and just navigating a cultural revolution to have something that is so relevant to catapult from and have as a platform.
I love that you keep on referencing your board and all the different people you work with. Are they all in some way involved in the arts of Kansas City, or are there people who don't know the first thing about fine arts or curating arts and people, but you just like the way they think, and they just, maybe they're the person who disagrees with you, or they bring an outsider's perspective. Are there people like that on the board, or is it kind of just like, all right, we want to get as many creative, artistic people in a room coming up with out of the box ideas, because that's what we need?
I think everybody is involved in the arts.
Mm-hmm. Dang it. I mean, so that was me positioning myself for a board position.
Yeah. Next, come on board.
I have outside the box ideas. And if you get me like thinking, I'll come up with something weird, but.
Can you come up with the box so we can know what we're outside of?
There we go. I like that. I like that. I'll find a way to wiggle my way on at some point.
Danny, I can say that it's to an extent. Honestly, like I started years ago, obviously pictures behind me. I started as a model. And so that was my only like aspect of art, is like wearing the art, modeling.
Okay.
The art, and your body is art. But in reality, I went to school and I studied pre-law, political science, and got my master's degree in communications. And so I'm, you know, in a different type of area. And so I get to bring that public relations and more so marketing. And I bring a different type of aspect to it, where they're thinking about the artsy side. And I'm like, wait, but let's think about this legal and this PR stuff.
So, yeah.
So, let's get the NDA signed.
Yeah, let's get the NDA signed.
And I don't, and the reason I ask that is because sometimes I feel like fine art and high fashion can have kind of a bit of a higher barrier to entry than other forms of art. And that probably has a lot to do with my ignorance and my, you know, just lack of trying. But at the same time, like we said at the beginning or before we started recording, I don't know much about this, but I'd love to learn more. So what are some good ways? What are some experiences Kevin and I can do to broaden our horizon and broaden our knowledge of the Kansas City art scene, and maybe get somewhere in that Venn diagram where our paths kind of cross and overlap?
I think if you support the arts, then you're involved in the arts. You know, okay. I mean, I can hear that you're self-conscious about your taste and your experience, but everyone's experience is as important as everyone else's. There's no hierarchy. I mean, that's what's so great about art, is that, you know, Calvin and I have spoken extensively about this idea of inclusive and exclusive. Like, we really like to create situations that feel very exclusive but are extremely inclusive. And that's what I've always strived with the West 18th Street Fashion Show, is that everybody feels like they are part of it. And, you know, our sponsors are returning sponsors because we treat each other well, and we treat our sponsors well, and we treat our audience well, because as April says, and as I know as Celeste is true, we're just working to make it bigger and better. And that doesn't mean physically bigger. It just means that, you know, it's just a matter of quality. But there's no reason to think, when you are looking at art or experiencing it, that
that you're included or excluded. Like your experience is just as valid as anyone's.
Okay. Yeah.
I think you should just try to get out there and go to as many different art venues of all kinds and find that one that's your jam, you know? Like for me, I love contemporary art and I love the quirky stuff. And through the filming of this movie, I was introduced to a museum I have never been to. And I love Kansas City, I'm all over the place. And I can't believe I never knew about this place. And when we went to scout it and then when we went to shoot in there, I love this museum and I cannot wait for this pandemic to, you know, play out. So I think just trying to experience as many things as you can. And honestly, there's a lot of free art experiences or very inexpensive art experiences in Kansas City. So just going and hitting up some of those lesser expensive ones, it, you know, gets you out of the box. You know, some people like to do the same thing every weekend. Maybe just try something different one weekend and maybe you lost $2 in the process that you didn't like, that wasn't the museum that you would be into, but maybe you find that museum that you're like, why have I never been here? Or it doesn't have to necessarily be a museum, but some kind of an experience. You know, I'm not an artist like Peregrine and Calvin are, but to me, art is whatever moves you. So whether it's
totally
what I saw, I'm not trying to kiss up to Peregrine, but when I was at her house last week and I saw this picture that she did of Calvin for the first time, like saw it, I got the whole, all the chills, all the goosebumps, you know, and I wasn't expecting it. Like, I'm just there to have a meeting with her. And next thing you know, like all my hairs are standing up. So you just never know. You just got to find what you like. And it's all over Kansas City.
Yeah. Art is in everything. You guys are a part of art as well as media professionals, you know, so you are creating a different type of art, which is going to be kind of new age, right?
Media amateurs at absolute best.
Yeah, right. And you're nominated for what, the pitch, right? Right. Right now.
We won it last year, but didn't even get nominated this year. It's sad.
Oh, you won. Won. You already got it. So yeah. I mean,
hey, it's art. Okay. It's not about winning and losing. Okay.
But, you know, this is where art is moving. Like, we're trying to bring our platform, our art, to TVs and screens everywhere, you know, and so that's where it's going.
Yeah. Calvin, what about you? Any suggestions, art around Kansas City that Danny and I could get more involved with? I mean, besides, like, when shows start happening again and we can see you perform?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything that's happening right now, there's a lot of stuff that's happening virtually. So, I mean, maybe you can even just like kind of like go down some social media like threads and like just kind of poke around there. And
you could do studio visits. I mean, there's still that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I live in Brookside and like right down the street is the big Black Lives Matter on the street right in front of on Brookside Boulevard and 63rd Street. So that's really cool to walk down and that's like a you can walk through it. So I'll continue to do that. Take my newborn son down there so he gets it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just be open to it. I mean, and you kind of attract the things that you know, the energy that you're putting out, you receive it back. So if you're curious about it, then keep your mind open to it and whatever way that you normally consume things visually, just be open to more interesting or curated things.
Awesome. Okay. And April, remind us again how we can get tickets to the show, when it is, where it is, in case anyone forgot after Celeste already told us at the beginning.
Yeah, if you'd like to get tickets to the show, please visit it. Well, first you can go to our website, West18thStreetFashionShow.com, and you can go to the tickets link. It'll take you right to Eventbrite, where you can see Summer in Hindsight, Director's Cut, and you can get tickets for two separate shows. There's two event times, so you can find one that suits your needs. Four to a car, by the way.
And okay. COVID friendly, COVID safe.
Very COVID safe.
No, yeah. Well, none of us are friends with COVID, but COVID's
right. There we go.
COVID unfriendly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thanks everybody so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And glad we got to learn a few things.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
All right. See you there.
All right. Thanks again to Peregrine, Celeste, Calvin, and April all for joining us. man, like I was like nervous to do the interview, so then I just couldn't get anybody's name right at all. And there was like all these different names that I was just like, I can't read. I truly have just memorized words. So a new word, I don't know how to sound it out anymore. I've forgotten how to
Nick,
do that.
Nick Miller.
I am Nick Miller.
I've memorized words.
That's it. But they were a treat. That was really fun to learn something new about a cool established event in Kansas City. 20 years strong. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I mean, and it's a little bit of a different interview for us, something that Kevin and I know very little about, you know, fine art and fashion. But I enjoyed it. And you guys have probably seen Calvin around town before. He's like 6'6", and he plays the harp and he sings. And he's at a lot of events around town. Super nice guy. And just really enjoyed, you know, talking about something a little bit different, stretching our range a little bit. And like you said, learning something new about something that's been happening in Kansas City for 20 years. That I didn't know about. And that was one of the huge reasons we started the show, was to learn more about KC. And that was a great opportunity.
I loved every assumption that you made in that interview was wrong, too.
Dead wrong.
Hilarious.
Dead wrong.
I wish it was a video podcast.
I know.
Because Danny is like kind of developing these questions with these assumptions. And like Peregrine's like shaking her head like as Danny's
kidding. I can't even finish the question. Before she's like shaking her head.
So wrong. He's just so wrong.
Actually, the exact that thought you had, actually, it's the exact opposite. Yes. That is actually true. So, but yeah, that I like that because
that was good.
And Peregrine too was just it. Yeah. And Peregrine, I appreciated that she wasn't afraid to tell me like no you're wrong. Not like good try, good effort. Just, it was just no
you're wrong. Yeah.
Appreciate
that. I could see it coming too. I like put myself on mute to laugh because I was like, oh man, she's just gonna own Danny because Danny sounds like a dummy. This is fantastic. I love
here
this
it comes.
All right, let's get into a little deets on the streets this week. This is brought to us by our dad John Ritz. He I think he was at like Indian Creek or something,
and he was on a walk.
Yeah, found, as old retired guys do, just walk, and found some deets on the streets about Knoll Avenue. So what'd you find out on Knoll Avenue?
Knoll is named after John Knoll, which
John Knoll
like couldn't be more perfect because it's such a boring name, and it's just so like. Oh, like if you were to be like, hey, who do you think Knoll is named after? You'd just be like, I don't know, some guy named John Knoll, probably. Like, ding, ding, ding. You're right. It's just kind of a get the job done type of name, type of street. It's
type of street it is.
Exactly. Nothing flashy. But John Knoll, he was a little flashy. He was born in 1832 in North Carolina, moved to Johnson County in 1859, where he had 9 kids with his first wife. She passed away, had another 6 with his second wife.
Still shooting.
So 15 kids for John Knoll. That's not very Knoll. I guess it's efficient, in which Knoll is. But Knoll has very few stoplights, which I guess John Knoll saw very few stoplights when it came to reproducing. He fought in the Battle of Westport in 1864. Which was in Loose Park. People forget about that. Like there was just a Civil War battle in Loose Park.
Who do you fight for?
Kansas, because he was lived in Johnson County. Yeah, so the Union. But basically, he was just a fruit farmer who had a house on 67th and Knoll. Now at 67th and Knoll, and pretty much just a regular guy with a lot of kids. Nothing special. Just got the job done. Kind of like his namesake, I think. I think they knew it was just like, hey, it's just a guy, just a regular guy.
Must have owned a lot of land or something there to get the street name.
He owned a lot of land and was one of the early people.
I wonder if there's any
area.
Knolls around Kansas City still. I mean, if he had 15 Knolls,
they're all buried in one cemetery. So he bought a cemetery. It's right around there. It's in Prairie Village somewhere. But basically, all 30 headstones in the cemetery are Knoll.
Oh, okay.
He died in 19. He died in 1917, and he wrote his own obituary, which is, I feel like, a efficient move. Yeah, very efficient. It's just like, you know what? I can tell my story. I got this. And
yeah,
I feel like that should come back in fashion. I mean, writing your own obituary, that's a solid move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to – there's got to be some nulls out there still. Very fascinating. All right. Those are the deets on the streets of Null. All right. Next, a little personal pine tar here. I switched mine here because it just came to me because when I got a little hungry. But, you know, Chiefs kicked off at 1:25 local time for me, and I was hungry and craving wings. And I was like, first off, sad because I was like, man, I can't get peanut wings. And then it's hard to just maybe find wings with a search, or maybe just was in my neighborhood. Because, like, a lot of the best wings, I feel like, sometimes just come from bars that don't have wings in the name or something like that.
I get what you're saying.
So it's like, and sometimes maybe, like, a pizza place has the best wings. And how am I to know? Uh-huh. So I was very nervous about trying to find wings to order. So I had to just settle for Wingstop and eat wings from
Kev.
Wingstop.
Oh, yeah. So, that's so disappointing.
I know. Like, just like trying to do something maybe local. I got a little intimidated by all the options. I didn't know truly, because like some of the wings out here, they were a little too fancy, and I just wanted classic buffalo wings. And I was like, I went to Wingstop, had them deliver, and they were good, and I liked them, and I don't like myself for that.
That's just so lame. That's just such a lame. So but I could see being like,
so lame.
I could see like getting hung, and like you want to do research, but like San Francisco is so freaking huge that it's like, what are you going to search? Biggest, best wings in San Francisco, and it's like an hour and a half away and not a chance.
So I was just overwhelmed and confused and just couldn't get local delicious wings like I'm used to.
All right. Well,
to go to the chain.
All right. Well, you've got an assignment for the next week.
Yeah.
Try to find the best wings in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll have to do that.
All right. I know exactly your thought process, because you're hungry and you're like, there's no amount of research I can do that will lead to a satisfying conclusion. And so screw it. I just want wings.
Wings,
that's
up.
Fair. Okay. I'm disappointed.
And I liked
in you,
them.
But
they were
I
good.
Can relate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. My personal pine tar is these freaking everything with a baby can kill the baby. So like everything you do with a baby can kill it, no matter what. If it's laying in a crib, if it's putting a mattress in a bassinet, everything can kill the baby. So everything has to come with warning labels and tags and all this shit that is just potential death. This can kill the baby, that can kill the baby. And so like if you, there's nothing that is just like nice and clean and well packaged. And even just like a little, you know, a little lounger, these little boppy loungers, there's just massive tags on them of warning signs that they have to print on there. And it's just really annoying. Like obviously I know like my baby's going to be fine. Like nothing's going to happen. So I'm not annoyed by the constant warning signs of a potential death of my baby. I'm annoyed because the tags, there's just tags and big signs everywhere, and nothing has a nice clean look of just tagless clean look. So
do they come off easy?
No, they're like, well, I mean, I guess I could cut them off, but like, I mean, look at this thing. It's just like a little lounge. It's just freaking tags
probably
everywhere.
In like five languages. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like the thick tags that are sewed into whether it's a car seat or like a baby Bjorn thing to carry the baby on or whatever it is, tags everywhere that are sewed in, and it's just annoying.
Yeah, really annoying. And it's just like constant reminders, everything can kill my child.
Exactly. So, but the tags are the more annoying thing.
Yeah, definitely. All right. I want to do a little California Kev, tell you about the most California thing I saw this week. I got to play a little golf on Saturday, and it was kind of in a mountainous region. I'm not going to lie, before like planning a drive out here, I didn't know that the mountain, there are so many mountains in California. Like, I just didn't know that. I'll just be honest. Like, I don't even know what mountain range that is. That is like going through the west or the east side of California, but it's a pretty big mountain range. And
okay.
I didn't really know about it. Didn't really know about it. And it's really close to the Bay Area. So I got to play some golf, very California golf. And at the turn, the special of the day, they had like fancy ramen bowls.
Okay, at a golf course?
At a golf course.
What?
I was like, because like ordering on the screen, they were like, today's special. And I was like, yeah, I'll check that out. It was ramen. I'm like, who's got time to eat a bowl of ramen at the turn? Like, that is one of the most difficult meals to eat, especially like if chopsticks are involved. You've got the hard boiled or the kind of the medium boiled eggs in there. You know, and it's not like a meal that you eat and then you're like, all right, let's go out and sweat some playing golf.
That's like the worst meal possible for a golf course.
Yeah, that was the most bizarre thing in California thing I saw this week. Offering to eat ramen at the turn.
Yeah.
At a golf
course. The only bizarre. A golf course needs one hot thing dog. At the turn. It needs a hot dog.
Yeah.
That's it. A good hot dog.
I got a hot dog. It was good. Okay. And so I was set. But
was it like
wild?
Okay. The mountain ranges, there might be the Santa Cruz Mountains or the Sierra Nevada Mountains, which, you know, the beer, Sierra Nevada. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Honestly, didn't know it was so mountainous out here, but here we are.
Here we are. Look at you. Yeah. That's wild. Yeah. All you need is a good hot dog. A good hot dog at the turn can just flip your round. And all you do is talk about it with the other three guys you're playing with, how good of a hot dog it is. And oh man, it's the best.
Yeah. I went 49 on the front, 43 on the back. Thanks to the hot dog.
Thank you, hot dog.
Thank you, hot dog. All right. Like we teased before the interview, we do have a mixed plate. We want to talk about fashion since we talked with the West 18th Street Fashion Show this week. So we're going to talk the mixed plate of regrettable fashion trends we participated in.
My list is long. We also have to try to come up with pictures of ourselves in these. That's a future you problem since you put together the mixed plate. Social media, which you didn't do this week.
Wow. Well, it depends on if I'm in the pool or not on Friday, cutting out a little early.
Go ahead. Get out of the pool. but I'll send you the pics of me.
Send me the pictures. And yes. Okay.
Okay.
All right. What episode? I think you're up. I think it's the 73 here.
Okay. Nice. Well, I'm going to do I've got my list of my most the fashion trends that I was the offender of most frequently.
That's what I have too.
Okay. My easy number one here. I this is not that recent. This was like late 2009, like 10, like juniors, like in high school and in college. So not super long ago, but I always did the, and I look at pictures and just hate myself for it. I did, matching the undershirt with the polo horse on your polo.
That's so
you
dumb.
Had to match.
I had that on my list too.
So if you had and you had to wear Ralph Lauren polos, like you didn't, you didn't fuck around with anything else. But if you had a Ralph Lauren polo with a yellow polo with a blue horse, you're dang right wearing a blue horse undershirt a blue undershirt to match that horse.
Yeah.
And I did it all the time. And I can even think of I had a yellow polo with a sky blue polo horse, and I would wear Royals powder blue shirts underneath, and it was just, it was money.
Yeah, I participated in that trend as well. And just like undershirts in general, why did I wear two shirts at the same time? That's I hate undershirts now.
I hate undershirts so much.
I literally do not own an undershirt. I don't own one.
I have to wear them because I pit out a little bit. I wear V-necks so that you can't see it. No one can see it. I've converted. I had multiple friends who still wore undershirts as of two years ago. And I've converted probably four or five people to V-necks. I'm like, all right, if you want to wear an undershirt, fine. But I don't want to see it. You're showing underwear. Yeah. That's underwear. I can see your underwear when I can see your undershirt.
Yeah.
So I was a big big offender of that.
All right. This is a one that I was definitely an offender of. I think you might have been too, and I think a lot of people were. I'm going to go with my meat number one being the black on black at a high school dance. Black dress pants with a black dress shirt and a tie. And that was like just 2005 to 2009 when I was in high school. So many people did it. It's ugly. I don't know why I thought it was cool, but black dress pants, black dress shirt, mm-hmm. high school dance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, that's an ugly look.
And so I'll go with my meat number two. That's very similar. It's a bright colored dress shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
you shouldn't hear. I don't know who needs to hear this. Travis Hunt needed to hear this for far too long, but you shouldn't wear a dress shirt that is any other color other than white or light blue. Like, you shouldn't wear dress shirts that are any other color than white or light blue. Like, and it was the same thing. Like a bright red dress shirt with like mm-hmm. a black and red tie or something. I have pictures of me at a college formal wearing that. Also a bright, like a really royal blue.
Like just solid color.
Yeah. Solid color that is bright and that color. Don't do it. Just wear a white dress shirt. You don't need any other dress shirts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, unless you're talking pattern and there's a nice pattern.
Yeah. If you've got like a nice.
If you're just talking a solid color, I agree. White.
A solid light, color.
White or
only
light.
White. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's see my meat number two here. This was probably high school and into college. I think I would wear. I would get purposely boot cut jeans. I did not own a pair of boots.
Yeah,
and they were very light washed. So mm-hmm. like light washed. Flare at the end mm-hmm. and I would wear tennis shoes with them.
Yeah.
And like even to the point where they were baggy enough to like kind of tear the hem.
They frayed
the
a little bit. Oh yeah.
Like that's the ugliest pair of jeans that you could own. And that's all I owned. And those are like the only jeans that I knew to buy. I was like, dark wash jeans, those are for like fancy boys. Like I don't want to wear that. That's way too fancy. I just want some boot cut light jeans.
It was also cool.
Light wash jeans, yeah.
It was also cool in high school to have your Dockers fray a little bit at the bottom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. My side number two.
Side number one.
I'm going with, I was just, so to make this list, I was going through really old Facebook photos. I was obsessed with horizontally striped anything.
Oh, dude, I had that too. I had like rugby style.
Rugby style shirts. Sweaters. Polos, button downs, jacket, anything, horizontal stripes. I was wearing it. And it's just everything. Like, and go through my Facebook photos. It's just horizontal stripe after horizontal stripe. I've not worn a horizontal stripe thing in probably 6 years now, hopefully longer, but I was obsessed with horizontally mm-hmm. striped sweaters, shirts, button downs, whatever.
Yeah. Hmm. Let's see.
The rugby styles were the worst. Like that was big in like high school was rugby style.
Yeah, I forgot our list would mash together because we shared a closet. I didn't think about that. Like now it's just coming to me. Like why do we have all the same ones? Like oh shit, we literally shared a closet for like 6 years. All right,
and we have the same mom who bought us all our clothes.
Yeah, exactly. Man, that's how the Old Navy, you know, was able to open up as many locations as it did.
Yeah.
But I'm back at the Old Navy. I freaking.
I am too. I buy all my jeans from Old Navy.
Yeah, me too. All right. Side number one. Let's stick with bottoms. I'm going. I participated in this plaid shorts, where like I don't. Yeah. Plaid, some whatever color they were. They
plaid
hung
shorts.
Below your. They yeah. They hung below your knee. I had a pair of maroon plaid shorts,
mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was my go-to. I had a maroon shirt that I would rock with it. Ooh. I thought it was freaking awesome, and I thought I was styling. Like, with the maroon shorts. I was very pleased with how those looked.
Yeah. Everyone had those plaid shorts that were definitely a fad in like 08, 09, probably like 06, 07.
I recently saw some dads out on the golf course wearing them too. So they're still around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, for sure. All right. That's a good one.
What's the joke that you can tell when a guy got married based on what his golf outfits look like?
Yeah, exactly. All right, my side number two. I'm doing this just for the content, so just make sure you put the mix plate out.
The picture out.
Senior year, I wore a white tux to prom.
Yes, the white tux
to prom. I was such a fucking tool. It's unbelievable. Like, this tux that I wore is the biggest tux I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, the coat goes down to my knees. And it was tailored. You know, I got it from a place. It was white pinstriped. I'm wearing a purple vest with it to match my date's purple dress. It is one of the most regrettable outfits that has ever been worn by anyone. And this outfit is incredible. And I remember, like, there was a certain group of guys who wore white tuxes to prom. And I mean, picture that guy in your head. Okay. That was me. I was one of those guys. I wore a white tux to prom. So, it's awful. I can't wait to put it out on social media.
Relive that.
It's something.
It's 2003 NBA draft fit. It is. I mean,
I look like Dwayne Wade.
Yeah.
Getting drafted. It's unbelievable.
Same cut. Yeah. It is. I can't wait to get that picture
it's
out.
So big.
Okay. Now I have a lot of motivation to get this post together. All right. I'm going to go with my side number two here. One that, wasn't clothing, but I'm going to call it a fashion trend. It was the sun-in in the hair.
Yep.
We were both guilty of this. You sprayed it in your hair, went out in the sun, turned just the top of your head, wherever you sprayed the sun in, which we just did the top of our heads, turned it blonde for the whole entire summer. So walking around, you know, pretty looking pretty tan. Got the darks on the side and then just the blonde hair on top.
It was
quite the look.
It's still a look among European soccer players for sure.
Okay, yeah. And then going, you know, sun in and then the skateboard ramp hair.
Yes.
Where you just gelled it, skateboard ramp.
Well, so skateboard ramp hair was like for school. After the sun in, maybe wore it down.
Yeah.
And it wasn't summer anymore.
So it wasn't quite frosted tips. I didn't quite get there.
No.
But pretty close. Pretty close. I'll have to see if mom and dad can find a picture of that because it was quite a look.
I've got one.
I mean, I was just big on cargo shorts and cargo pants too.
Yeah. Like baggy and like sagging pants. Like I already have. Like, tailors have told me, I already have a long torso and, like, short legs. And so it already kind of looks odd. And when I sagged, it looked like I was just, like, all torso and no legs.
Yeah, sagging. And then basketball shorts that purposely, like, would try to get to mid-shin with basketball shorts, too.
Yeah.
That was
caring about, like, your socks, too, during basketball season. That was a weird trend. Mm-hmm. I have the super gelled hair. Yeah.
Yeah, I have the fossil watch.
Like, yeah,
everyone had to get like the silver like linked fossil watch, and it, yeah,
girls had to get the G Baby watch. This was a 7th grade, so like 2001, 2002 type of the Hawaiian shirt unbuttoned with just a plain white undershirt.
Dang,
underneath
that was
it.
Tight. Yeah. Yeah, that was a good look.
That was a solid look. You'd wear that to like the skating rink or you know, field trip
get the flow on the
skating. Get the flow and just a nice like thick white undershirt underneath it.
Yeah.
That was nice. I used to do this in high school. I'd wear a hat like only on the back side of my head, you know, and so you could see my curly hair coming out the front. and the curly hair kind of, it was kind of like an Alabama like quarterback thing back in Tua days when that show came out. But like MTV, people would do it
just
like that.
Barely put the hat on the top of your head.
Just a regular hat, you know,
like sticking almost straight up. Yeah.
Something with like cocks across the front. And it was like a, it was like an Arkansas or South Carolina. Like one of those college hats that was just barely on the back of my head. So you could see the curls coming out from everywhere. That looks so stupid. Have you ever done that? Have you done that recently?
No, but
go
I
put on a hat. Go put on a hat and do it. You just feel like such an idiot.
Oh man, yeah, that's a good one. All right, yeah, those. I can't wait to hear from people like what else they got into, because oh man, there are some, you know, regrettable early 2000s, even into college fashion choices that were definitely made. So. All right. Thanks again to our guests from the West 18th Fashion Show for joining us. Let's see. I think that's kind of it for this week. We'll be back next week to talk more, wrap up the Royals season, talk a little Chiefs, talk some golf with our next interview as well. So, yeah, lots to look forward to. Lots coming at you. Be sure to follow us on social media @StateYourLine. Check us out, stateyourline.com. See you around, Kansas City.